Welcome to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue. I'm Diana Isaacs and I'm with my wonderful co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we are actually live at the ADCES Technology Conference in Chicago. And for this episode, we're really fortunate to have the amazing Jane Seely. And so you're so amazing. You have so many titles. Do you mind sharing a little bit of background information for our viewers
Yes,
and
welcome,
listeners?
Dr. Seely. Sure. So I am a diabetes nurse practitioner and assistant professor of medicine and Walcom Hill Medicine in New York City. I have worked in diabetes almost my entire career. I will not tell you how long that has been, in various hospitals and outpatient practices. I'm currently working at Walcom Hill Medicine. And I just love it. I work in the inpatient setting most of my time. And I call it the Wild West because I feel like I'm an FBI agent there, and I have to constantly, and because you've done some inpatient recently, that you have to constantly observe what people are doing and look very carefully in the electronic health records to see the sequence of events so that you can educate people. And for those diabetes care and education specialists that might be listening to this that work inpatient, I really hope that, you feel empowered with what I'm about to talk about, to be able to say, hey, why don't you try this instead of that, because that's really, we can't sound like, we know it all and just tell people what to do. We have to kind of ease them into it. Because unfortunately, there's a lot of people out there still doing sliding scales in
Yeah,
hospitals. Even in big cities and academic medical centers.
right.
So we're gonna fix it though, right?
We're
Yes,
going to fix it.
absolutely.
Yeah, so I've been really privileged to serve on ADA's Professional Practice Committee with Jane, and that's the committee that updates the ADA standards of care. So 2023 has probably come out by the time you're seeing this. So, Jane, do you mind just
So
sharing?
lucky me got to write the inpatient management section. And it was a very interesting process. So, if you're not familiar with the process, what happens is the first thing we do is a literature review. And we look at everything since the last year when it was done, anything new that's been published, especially systematic reviews, anything that really would either change your recommendation or strengthen the recommendation and make it that you would have a higher recommendation for it. So the level of evidence might change. So we did deep dives, and I found that there was a tremendous amount of work done, no surprise, because of COVID, in technology, and particularly CGM in the hospital. And there was tons of papers on that, and I was really delighted about that. So we will talk about that. And there was also a lot of work done with anything electronic in terms of ordering diabetes management, which I'm very happy about because the one thing I've learned in the inpatient setting, if they can click on it, they'll order it. So I'd like to tell you, and I wrote it down because I don't know if I'll remember it all
Yeah,
in a
please do
pinch.
share.
Four things changed in the 2023 standards of practice. It's actually an expansion of what was already written,
And just to
but
clarify, this is the inpatient part,
Right,
right?
the
Because
inpatient
I know there were
management.
lots like overall,
Oh,
so there's like,
but inpatient, there was only certain areas that have really have been studied in the last year, so I didn't have a lot to inform my changes. So in the case of the electronic health record and order entry, there's been more and more papers that show that electronic orders will really guide people to order the right thing. And I'm an Epic champion. And I spent a lot of time developing. Since 2009, I've been doing insulin order sets at New York Presbyterian for all 10 sites, actually, what we do. And I have learned that it makes a tremendous difference in what someone orders. And we make these comprehensive order sets. So when you order the insulin, you're getting the hypoglycemia treatment, you're getting the meal plan, you're getting the glucose monitoring, all of it. Everything is all in one place, and everything is pre-selected that can be pre-selected, which is most of it. So the new papers that have come out have supported that, but not only that, I'm seeing more and more interesting dosing algorithms for insulin. So we're going to see, and Epic is working on this also nationally. You're going to see more and more like calculators that come up that you can calculate insulin doses for both sub-Q and IV insulin.
Oh, that's
So
great.
that's the wave of the future. And I recently did a study with an DKA order set, where I wanted it to be nurse directed. The one that we had, the nurse every single hour had to check the blood sugar and go get an order to change the rate of the drip. And we actually came up with an idea to make it nurse directed, which only some hospitals do, surprisingly. And I learned that everybody was happy. Doctors didn't want to be bothered every hour. Right. The nurses didn't want to go find them. And in fact, it standardized what everybody was doing.
Right.
So when I did the initial chart reviews, I found that the answer to the question of the blood sugar is blah, 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 what should I do, was highly variable. So these kinds of things are really what we should be doing. And I'm glad that the ADA is strongly supporting that. The next one, this is my big one, the glucose targets in the hospital.
Yes.
So, you know, the evidence is really weak. There's not enough studies, and they mostly say 140 to 180. Think about that person on a general floor, not in critical care, who's eating meals and is getting better. Why would you want them to be 140 to 180?
Right.
So if you talk to, you know, each other in course settings, you find that most people do something like 100 to 180. So definitely 180 is the tipping point, but how low should you go?
Yeah.
These are not outpatients, these are inpatients. And when someone's really sick, when they're under 100, they probably can't even tell you that they're feeling lower. It feels a lot like the infection they have,
yes,
their heart's racing, right, you know, all of these things. So, or they can't even tell you any symptoms. So I did a really deep dive on the 100 to 180, and I looked at lots of guidelines, and I actually couldn't find any evidence to support it. And I also saw that the Endocrine Society guidelines used 100 to 180, so I contacted them, and they had not found any evidence to support it.
Wow.
But you know what? This is really expert opinion to, like, the 20th power.
Yeah,
we're all saying, this is what seems to work. Why can't we say this?
Right.
So I stand by this, especially for people with new hyperglycemia, and it's already more commonly used for people with known diabetes. So 100 to 180 for people who are general floors, not acutely ill, not critically ill, I'm sorry, and they're eating meals.
And I mean, it's a good point, because sometimes it's hard, something's our expert opinion, because it's hard to design a trial specifically showing 100 versus 140. I mean,
it's almost unethical, isn't it?
Right. It would be unethical. So, I mean, sometimes we do have to rely on expert opinion.
And it was something like that with the NICE sugar trial, but that was in ICU.
Right.
And that was all different kinds of treatments people got. It was a very poorly designed study, in my opinion. I hope none of the authors are listening. Okay, so next one. There's only four of them. We're halfway. The next one is, this is my tribute to Dr. Umpierrez, my hero and mentor. He's been doing so many studies with his colleagues at Emory, and other places have followed in his pathway of saying, hey, not everybody needs basal bolus in the hospital. If the glucoses are under 240 or 250 or whatever number each study used, but it was in that area, we could try oral agents on some of these people, and we could use the orals with basal insulin if they needed to lower the fasting and give them a better start to the day. And we could have a correction order in case what we thought was going to work doesn't work, and we could see how much correction they use. So I had so many studies that he's done and others have done that have been doing this. So if you add them all up, the end is better. You know, unfortunately, there's all studies, but there's so many of them. So what we're seeing now is, I believe in, if the glucose is under 240 with someone with type 2 diabetes, you should consider using select oral agents. So, for example, at New York Presbyterian, I've gotten the formulary changed with my colleagues. So we have a DPP-4, we have metformin, and we have glucagonide, which we do have a glucose control, but I prefer glucagonide because it's much shorter acting.
Right.
And, you know, a patient in the hospital, you give them that glucose control in the morning, and you think they're eating three meals, and then whoops,
they're vomiting, or they're somewhere.
So I'm like using the long acting secretagogue. So we actually implemented this protocol during COVID.
Okay.
because we didn't have the resources for the kinds of blood sugars. People came into the hospital with the craziest blood
Right.
sugars I've ever seen in New York in my life. And we didn't have the staffing ability. Everybody was so stressed. We had ICUs all over the place. So we tried to do something easier for the patients that were less acute. And we tried the protocol and it worked fine. And I think a lot of other people tried it also during that time. So I highly recommend you try that, and it's supported in the recommendations. And the last one is my favorite. So the FDA gave us permission, at least temporarily, they haven't taken it away yet, that we can use CGM on hospitalized patients. So I think everybody went wild with that. And
right.
using it in ICU, using it in non-ICU, trying this, trying that, only using it on DKA patients. You know, people had all different kinds of permutations.
Yeah.
There are so many studies
right.
with so much data. And I know that there's efforts off the record that are being done to take all of that data and put it into a database so we can analyze that.
Okay.
So we're going to know a lot more about this. And I think it's going to convince the FDA, who is quite interested, that this is something reasonable, and we're going to learn how we can do it. So I have a lot of new references in the standards, especially on this topic, and everything I've mentioned, I've added references, but this particular topic, there was plenty of really good studies that were done. The last thing, which is probably the most important thing, is the ADA recommendation for people who come into the hospital with their own continuous glucose monitor insulin
right.
delivery device.
Yeah, what do you do about that?
To support them in every way we can, with certain ramifications about it, that they have to be able to do it or have a support person, a family member, do it for them. And I've had that.
Right.
When the patient
right.
can do it, but the family member, especially in pediatrics, you see that a lot, but even adults, where they would come in and stay with them all day. And if they weren't there for a meal, we would just give them some Q insulin to cover that meal. So it was
right.
fine.
Right.
I feel it's really important. You know, I once used an analogy that taking someone's pump away from them in the hospital, if they were capable of doing it, would be like taking their dentures. And I really mean that.
Right.
So that's worked out really well that we had support to do that.
Question though, what do you do about the supply? Like, what if a person
so that's staff? Part of the discussion.
Right.
I do keep a stash, but I've been burned. I had one person stay in. We never thought this would happen, but they were there for 6 weeks. And my poor
wow.
rep for that pump company, she said, "We can't do this again. You took my entire territory supplies
oh
from
right.
all
yeah.
my customers."
Right.
So they have to, within a reason, you know, sometimes people have something happen that they urgently come into the hospital.
Right.
So I give them a couple of days. And of course, when they go to radiology a lot and they just put on this sensor,
right, it's got to come off.
I pay them back. I keep a stash to pay
right.
them back.
I wonder, like, would it be possible for, like, pharmacies and the hospitals to store these and bill bill the insurance?
We can't do that because we're inpatient, so we can't build the insurance
right.
for an outpatient thing.
But what about for, like, what do you do for the inpatient medication?
No, but that's not really built.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
It's bundled.
Right.
It's bundled.
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think there was
right.
a way that there could be something.
Yeah. I wish
right.
it were true.
Yeah.
I'm sure
right.
we'd get
yeah.
in a lot of trouble trying that.
Right. And the other challenge too becomes, so now you have all these supplies and they're sitting in your closet
right.
or whatever. They can expire.
Right.
Or someone says, "I can go get that," and they bring the wrong infusion set up or the wrong cartridge because it's a different brand of pump. People don't mm-hmm. realize the multiple different things going on. So that's another challenge too.
And the
right?
other challenge is that the patients come into the hospital, don't know they're staying, like they come in for same day surgery and get
and
admitted.
Then
they don't bring their
right.
chargers.
Right.
So
right.
they're sent to their pump, everything's dying.
Right.
So I got extra ones. I keep them in the nursing office.
Oh right.
Yeah. And the companies gave them to me. So
right.
it's no big deal.
Right.
So if that happens, at least we can load them one.
I think that's the challenge with you being the queen of inpatient diabetes, because I think in lots of other smaller systems, they don't have you as a resource, right? There isn't this global person that says, this is how we're going to do pumps or CGM in our hospital, and this is how we're going to, I mean, ultimately what you're doing is protecting the patient and fostering them feeling more empowered with their diabetes while they're an inpatient and hopefully improving their outcomes, right? How do we get that? You know, that's, I think the next question is, what do you do when we don't have a Dr. Seeley in a hospital?
It's interesting that you say this, because I always said in the hospital that I don't want to take someone's pump away and give them sub-Q insulin, because
right.
we know the pump is better. And then I would say, well, but in the ICU, the drip is better.
Right.
But I don't believe that anymore with
right.
AID. So that's fine.
Exactly.
I want that automatic insulin delivery device to be supported. And we, you know, we don't know. And the guidelines that were written by Diabetes Technology Society on CGM and AID, which is a great paper if you haven't looked at it, and it's free on their website. We don't know, it's expert opinion, you know, but so
right.
we try it and we see what happens.
Right.
And as long as it works, we keep them on it. And if it doesn't work, then we have to go back to the infusion.
Right.
But at least we have to try to support it the best that we can. I want to tell you, because I know we're running out of time, and I'm very excited about a project I worked on quite some time for ADA. Entire focus issue of diabetes spectrum. This is the third time I've done it for them over the years. So the fall 2022 issue of Diabetes Spectrum is, I was the associate editor. And Misha Zilberman, who's an endocrinologist hospitalist, he's an overachiever at Hopkins, he was my guest editor. We devoted an entire issue to inpatient management.
I saw that. I just had that on the table.
Yeah. Yes. Congratulations.
I'm really, really
well,
proud of
well
it.
Done.
So I'm going to just quickly run through the papers that
Please
are in
do.
There.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so the first one, and we could have talked about a million things.
Yes.
We tried to stick to hot topics, that
right.
we had something to say that's new and valuable. So if you don't know by now, you are hearing that CMS cares, believe it or not, finally, about severe hypoglycemia and hyperglycemia in the hospital and wants to make it a hospital wrong measure. It's about time. So hospitals haven't been equipped to
right.
do anything about that. And everybody's been scrambling and asking each other, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And I just recently learned that Epic is working on a whole like system to do it that's going to be embedded in Epic. So for those of you that have Epic like me, you will be able to do it quite easily to track it. So this is a really comprehensive piece that tells you exactly what it is, how it came about, and what you need to do. So it helps you to plan for it. And that's out of Hopkins. The next one is out of Ohio State, and it's on supporting personal diabetes technology, which is a very important topic, as we just discussed. So it's really a how-to of how you can do it, when you can leave it on, when you should take it off, and what you should do when you do take it off. So that's very important. The next one, I love the title, The Devil is in the Details. It's about CGM use in the hospital when you're using hospital-owned CGM.
Oh, okay.
And this was done at Lady Beth Israel in Boston in partnership with the University of Pittsburgh. And it's a very comprehensive paper about accuracy, implementation, roadblocks, different
what
populations.
Kind of CGM? Were they using like professional CGM or what was the
purchase? No, you need to know the result.
Right.
Well, now you can turn the Dexcom on to see it, but no, they were using regular.
I was given by the hospital.
Talking about all so both the Libre and the Dexcom
okay.
were used in hospitals.
Well, yeah, we actually have an out like a discharge program, so we put them on as they're
as
giving,
a
but we're not. They're versus
right,
only using them towards
so
the
that's a good point.
Right.
So those personal CGMs that we get to put on people shouldn't be used while they're in the hospital. So in the last day or two before they leave, you teach them how to do it, put them on it, introduce it to it, and let them see the numbers and see what the point of care says. So they begin to understand about the trend arrows
right.
and what the expectations are.
Right.
So we have it as a discharge program also. And I have a lot of pharmacists helping me. They're my best helpers.
Oh, right.
But
right.
I'm telling you, I love those
pharmacists.
They're
loving CGM.
They're loving CGM, and
also allowing
them.
All of us to work in our own. You can't do this. You have days off. You have things to do. You have meetings to go to. We can't individually fix it by ourselves. We were just talking. We need a team. So everyone that can should be part of this solution. I love that you're using pharmacists and other healthcare professionals that are already there. It's important, right?
And you want to try the warfarin at least 5 days a week, if not seven.
Yes, I agree with that. You can't have patients who show up on Friday night, not get any services until Monday, and now they're already gone. And so don't get sick on a Friday as a person with diabetes. Is that our message? No, it should be offered as often as we can. Obviously, there are things that don't happen on the weekends in hospitals, but I love that approach.
I really think the discharge CGM is going to make a big difference because you're able to follow that patient when they leave for the next 10 to 14 days.
Right.
And what I do is I hook them up with my counterpart, an outpatient, to follow them.
Love it.
And now the pharmacists are interested in making calls to see how people are doing.
Right.
So I want it to be as collaborative as possible.
Right.
You know, and it's really great for the pharmacy, their residents, they call themselves residents, the students. I think it's great that they're learning this.
Right.
So the more that we're able to have communications, we can discover, unfortunately, some amazing things that aren't so good that you find out. Like I had this guy recently, brand new diagnosis. Thank God I had nothing to do with this, what I'm about to tell you. The guy comes in, he's developed type 1, he has really high blood sugar, he's very smart, he's a college student. No, he graduated. You know, he's bright, he could learn anything you'd want to teach him. And he was in the ICU, DKA, and discharged from the ICU, and that's always a problem with education. Because the ICU nurses aren't used to doing diabetes teaching, especially teaching someone everything like that. And he goes home, and he's never actually given himself an insulin injection. And I was away, so I found out about this after the fact. So, and it wasn't in my institution. It was at another institution asking me for help. And so what happened was he went home and he read all the information, and he decided not to take the long-acting insulin because somewhere in what he was reading, it said something about if you inject too deep in the muscle, it's dangerous. Oh, so gosh. Here he is, a brand new type 1. He's only taking his short-acting.
Oh, right.
And he's not taking his long-acting. And he did figure out the meter, and that seemed to be going well. So this happens all the time, you know. So we need to have as many people on our team trained.
Right.
So the PharmDs are now doing diabetes education.
Love it.
And they're doing meters and CGMs they've learned, and they're doing the insulin pens, and they're doing a really fantastic job.
Right.
That's great to hear.
And my job is that every year since I started in 2004, I've been writing this diabetes self-care guide. And I translated it into Spanish and Chinese because those are our primary languages.
Do you personally know Chinese?
No, I
get help. Okay.
I use teaching staff, especially fellows and residents. And I have one person translated and then the other one translated back. But I actually got a grant. So now I said, you know what, I'm tired of rewriting this book every year. And there's so many new meds and all, and there wasn't a section on CGM and all these things. So I put together a team from multiple campuses, pharmacist, nurse practitioner, nutrition people. I mean, all these different people, six of us. And we have all the same person already. We meet so often. We meet like twice a month. Lunchtime, and we do it on Zoom because we're all different campuses, and we write the sections and go through them, and the book is about to come out in a much better version than I ever did by myself. I used to do it myself with my DNP students, and with the money we're getting from the grant, we're going to translate it into Spanish and Chinese properly using a translation service.
Right.
But you see, once you have something like that you can monitor yourself, and you can make sure that what's everything that's in it is what we say.
Right.
Because when you purchase things, especially these programs that the hospital keeps paying for, I don't agree with half the things. And they use language, diabetic, control, regimen, all the words I hate.
Good, bad,
And I just don't want that. So this is something that we'll be able to do on an ongoing basis. And this way, any nurse, pharmacist, whoever is going in to teach, dietitian, whoever is teaching the patient, opens up the book. And that's you know, like if you're teaching hypoglycemia, they're not going to tell them the wrong numbers. They're not going to tell them the wrong treatment amounts.
Right.
And that's what happens when you don't have something like this.
Right. Love it.
So I think that's really important. So we digress, and I left out the rest of this wonderful supplement. So let me go back to that. So we left off with the CGM and the hospital devil in the details, which I love that title. And the next one is really great. So Houston Methodist, which is part of Weill Cornell, even though it's in Houston, that team, I called on them because I knew they had done a lot of work, and they published something in endocrine practice, maybe somewhere they published something already about using alternatives to basal bolus in patients that will well manage.
Right.
Very similar to the whole idea about what I did with the DPP-4s instead of bolus insulin. They did a bunch of really interesting ideas. So they did it as case-based.
Right.
And I have to tell you, it's a really great read. They did a really, really good job. So that's on non-critical care alternatives to basal bolus. So that's a good one. The next one is enteral feedings and TPN. That is really hard to manage.
Yep, yeah,
and there's really not a lot of strong evidence.
Right.
So I asked my buddies at University of Nebraska, who do a really good job with this,
right,
and the endocrinologist and their PharmD that's very involved and dietitian, they all wrote this together, and it's great about glycemic management. And the last one is out of Hopkins, and it's about challenges and solutions for discharge planning.
Wow.
And that's very
right.
Hard. And
right.
They did a really deep dive with all the different medications and what to think about. You know, that's what my most common consult I get every day is, so-and-so's in the hospital, we don't know what to send them home on. And if I wasn't involved, many times they would either leave them on basal bolus when clearly this person either doesn't need it or could never pull it off, or both,
right?
And they don't know one agent from the other. These are hospitalists. I mean, why would they know these agents like we do? You know, when there's so many different things we could try for different reasons, and they'll put two things together that work the same way.
Right.
Like a GLP-1 and a DPP-4, or the other day I got repaglutide and glipizide together.
Oh, wow.
Whatever you think is crazy, I've seen it. So I feel like this is a really important overview of all the different agents and why you would use one over the other. It's really well done. So I'm very proud of this issue, and I hope that people get a chance to take
congrats.
A look at it.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm still reading through it, but I can't wait to finish it.
An amazing accomplishment. Well, it really is. And I love that you pulled from all different places in the country even. Because it just adds to the diversity of what we're doing. You know, you think everyone does it the way we do it, and we all know as clinicians it's not true. So I love that you just went, okay, who's good at this?
Let's that's exactly what
who's
I did.
Doing this,
well,
right?
A shining star for each topic.
And I love that. Right. Yeah.
And they were very willing, and really they got their papers in on time.
Which is amazing.
That is
right.
Amazing.
We're
they
not
were highly motivated. They highly motivated to contribute to this issue because, you know, there's not a lot written about inpatient management.
Right.
You know?
And it's such critical information to have. And I think a lot of hospitals are floundering in that. Like, what do we do now? And how do we get the training done? Because I also know you've talked a lot in our relationship together about the amount of actual training that you do with all the staff. Right, it's endless training. Right, it's always be training. It's almost like that's your mantra: always be training. Always look for things that didn't go right, and instead of blaming, and you just go back in and say, "Let's just walk through this one more time. Let's find a way to make this never happen again."
I'm glad you brought that up because I have a new topic I started at the beginning of this year, and I've done it now for several different medicine grand rounds, including Cornell in Qatar on Zoom, of course. It's a long plane ride for me.
Yep.
And it's on diabetes technology. I also do it in the medical college for the first years. The nurses, the dietitians, everybody's getting this lecture. So I'm going into and multiple campuses. I'm doing this lecture on diabetes technology because I want people to know what people are wearing.
Right.
And I'm going to tell you a story that is so unbelievable. You're going to fall off your chair as our ending. A good friend of mine who you know, but I'll remain nameless, who has type 1 diabetes for a very long time, also has sleep apnea. And she was a patient in an academic medical center in the New York City area. And she was lying in bed with her CPAP on, and the nurse came into the room and asked her to loop her insulin pump.
Oh, gosh.
This is how bad it is.
Right.
People don't know about these devices. More and more people are using them.
Right.
And it's very important. I want to create a culture where people know what they are.
Right.
Know that they're valuable. Encourage people to stay on them if they can. Right. And support them in any way that they can. And one thing that's interesting is I added all the 800 numbers to the technology policy, which I expanded my pump policy to include CGM and other things. Yeah. And all the toll-free numbers are there, and I encourage the house staff to call when there's an issue. If the pump's beeping or something in the middle of the night, they want to know, don't wait for endocrine in the morning. Call the toll-free number. They love it.
Right.
They find it fascinating.
Yeah.
So there's so much for us to do, especially as diabetes care and education specialists, you know, to be leaders in making sure that when a person comes into the hospital with diabetes or hypoglycemia, that they get everything that they need.
Right.
I don't want to hear from patients, I was in the hospital and they did this to me and that to me. You know, they would never do it all.
Right.
It should never happen.
Thank you so much for being such a leader in this space.
Yes.
You are the leader, and I'm really grateful. So thanks so much, Dr. James Dealey, and
thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you all for attending this episode of Diabetes Dialogue.